Thank you, Kieran. I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to talk to this prestigious audience, and I'd also like to acknowledge all my many collaborators on the TerraScale Supernova Initiative. If there's one thing, well, hopefully you'll learn a lot from this talk, but if there's one thing that you walk away from, I'd like it to be that you have to be very careful about what happens in multi-dimensions, because it can often fool you. Very brief outline. I want to describe the context of these accretion shock models in terms of the full supernova theory, which we'll hear more about in the following talk, and then show you what we've done to study this spherical accretion shock instability and measure its complex growth rates. And then I'll give you my interpretation of what is driving this instability, and perhaps mention some alternative theories. And then show you what happens in three dimensions. And if I have time, since this workshop is about the remnants of supernovae and GRBs, hopefully show you an example of a remnant. So here's the requisite slide for supernova physics, which I'm going to just skip over and let our next speaker give you all the lowdown. But hopefully everybody is familiar with the current paradigm of Kirk-Clapp supernovae. What I'm looking at is this post-bounce phase where we have an accretion shock that has stalled out at a radius of a couple hundred kilometers. We have the outer core raining down on this accretion shock, and inside is a protoneutron star. And in between, we have a gradually settling solution, accretion solution, settling down onto the surface of that protoneutron star. Now, there's a lot of physics going on here. And for the last 10 years or so, a lot of attention has been put on the multidimensional effects and the idea that there could be various convective instabilities inside the protoneutron star. There's likely to be convective instability because the neutrinos are heating the gas at the base of this gain radius, and so you're heating from below and you drive convection. But it also turns out that if you look closely at the dynamics of the shock, that shock wave itself is unstable. And so there's a lot of physics going on. And what I'm doing here is trying to isolate and just study the physics of that stalled accretion shock. So we construct a model here where we have an initially spherically symmetric accretion flow. We have a constant mass accretion rate from the outside coming in at free fall velocity. And we construct the solution so this shock just naturally sits there in steady state, and the post-shock flow is gradually settling in. You can get a very nice description of the physics involved in this phase from the 2001 paper by Janka in ANA, I believe. It gives a nice summary of the physics that goes in here and gives some justifications for some of these ideas. Here's just a radial profile showing the green line is one of our solutions that we use to model. In fact, we take it from Hawken Chevalier, which has a general solution parameterized in terms of cooling parameters. But comparing this with a very high-end 1D spherically symmetric model, this particular one with the red dots comes from Liebendorfer et al. And so here's the shock radius out at 200-something kilometers. And you can see, for large range, it's a fairly nice fit. Out here, we have a gamma 4/3 gas, very nicely models the accretion flow. Inside of about this point, we've got trapping of neutrinos, and the equation state becomes more complicated because of nucleons, and the physics is just much messier. But what I'm going to argue is that what I'm studying, the shock dynamics, the SASE, is really affected by what's going on out here anyway. So for this particular problem, studying the accretion shock, this model is a nice tool. One important point is that we've constructed this model so it is convectively stable. The entropy gradient, there's no entropy gradient, it's flat. And so what we've essentially done is remove this issue of convection so we can look solely at the dynamics of the shock. All right, the first thing we do here is run one-dimensional models, and it provides a nice way of verifying the time-dependent accuracy of our code. This code verification is something that SF physicists tend to neglect, but here's an opportunity where there's a nice linear stability analysis that provides some complex growth rates. We can go try and mimic those with our hydrocode and come up with some very nice agreement. So that gives us some confidence that we're on the right foot. So here is the spherical accretion shock instability in two dimensions. On the left is pressure. It's actually pressure times radius to the 4, which kind of flattens out the profile, so it's easier to see perturbations. And on the right is entropy. Entropy, because there's, until you get down close to the accreting protoneutron star, there's no effective cooling, and so the entropy is roughly constant in the flow. So what the entropy perturbations just advect with the flow. And what you see is that there's pressure perturbations sort of popping up along the poles. So you get high on one end, low on the other, and it switches back and forth. And those perturbations grow with time and start to push that shock, and the whole thing starts to grow to nonlinear scales. And you get rather large deformations of the shock. So we can excite different modes, L equals 0, L equals 1, L equals 2, and you've even seen some L equals 3. We're going to plot the power in various quantities as a function of time and try and fit those with a complex growth rate, and this is what we come up with. So the top is the imaginary part of omega, which is the oscillation period, and the bottom is the real part. So if that's positive, it's unstable. If it's negative, it's stable. So the parameter down here is the standoff distance. So out here, you have a shock that's very far away from your accreting surface. Down here, the shock is very close to your accreting surface. And for the relevant ranges for quark-clap supernovae, the spherical mode is stable, but the L equals 1 mode is always unstable, unless you're pushed way down, so the shock is barely standing off of that neutron star. So another important point is that we've gotten these results with several different codes. These are different algorithms, very different algorithms, and so it's not something that's an artifact of the code itself. Also recently, a Japanese group, Anishi et al., published some results that look identical to this. So they have growth curves that look very similar to that, where they include neutrino heating that they can tune, so they can turn convection on and off and find that you get the same growth rate. So this SASE operates independent of convection. You can have convection driven by neutrino heating going on. That's not going to change the physics of the SASE. All right, so what is this beast? This is my interpretation. I'm 98% sure of it, but enough uncertain that we're going to continue to discuss with Thierry and try and sort this out. But let me tell you what I think is going on, and that is that this is a global acoustic mode. So this accretion shock acts just like an acoustic cavity, okay? And you can excite all sorts of modes in there. But this particular mode where you just fit in one wavelength and you have pressure propagating from pole to pole turns out to be the one that's amplified most by this instability. If you just draw a path that gives you, if you're moving at the local sound speed from one pole to the other and draw a path that gives you the oscillation frequency of the SASE, then this dashed line is what you get. So it's just showing that this pressure wave propagating around the interior accreting neutron star is consistent with this period you get. Now, why does it grow? Well, if the pressure is high on one pole, that's going to push the shock out a little bit. But if you push the shock outwards, the ram pressure at the shock is going to decrease because you're at a higher distance from the neutron star. And so here's our steady state shock position. We perturb it out here. The pressure just behind the shock is a little bit lower. Thank you. But because the post-shock pressure varies as r to the minus 4, if we do this slowly enough, then the post-shock pressure is going to be actually, at a fixed radius, is actually going to be higher. So you have a high pressure in this region. It pushes the shock out a little bit. The effect is to amplify that pressure. And so we have this positive feedback increasing the pressure. So that wave coming back to the other side is now stronger. It pushes the shock out down there, gets stronger. And after every oscillation, you amplified this pressure by a factor of 2. And it doesn't take long before the whole thing runs away. Okay. The competing idea, when we first saw this instability, we referenced some work by Thierry Fritzo. And the idea there is that you advect some kind of vorticity perturbation, and at some radius, that couples to an acoustic wave that propagates back out, hits the shock, and that perturbing that shock creates a vorticity that propagates inward. So it's again some kind of cycle. So you know, that has some relevance to this as well. There's I'll point out that Martin has a poster out there trying to do some analytic description of this model. All right, so let me move on to the nonlinear phase. This is just putting in some particle tracers. So initially, you can see those things are moving more or less radial. But the key here is that once this thing gets going, the flow is extremely non-radial. In fact, you'll see, you know, some material gets accreted directly onto that protoneutron star. Other markers just go flying off. So radial flow is just totally out the window by the time this thing becomes nonlinear. All right, I want to make the point here that all this in these models is driven purely by the dynamics of this shock wave. Okay, there's no convection. There's nothing happening at the surface, the secreting star that's going to affect the flow. It's all driven by the shock wave. And to kind of illustrate that, let me take this just random time snapshot, but replot it in, so here's radius versus angle. So this line here is the surface of the accreting star. Just so you can see, here's the flow coming straight in. And what's driving all this flow is really both the time dependence of the shock and also the obliquity. So the accretion flow comes straight in, hits the shock at an angle, and is deflected and creates this very strong stream coming down towards the accreting star. The coloring here is entropy, and this part of the shock turns out to be receding, so the relative velocity is lower, you get lower entropy. This part of the shock is being driven out because the stream comes in, this flow pushes out and pushes that shock out. It's moving out faster, you get higher entropy. So everything we're looking at here is being driven by the dynamics of the shock wave. So early on when we were doing two-dimensional simulations, we let this thing run for a long time and we got this bipolar structure. But again, let me just point out that everything happening here is we've got these streams of low entropy gas coming in around the equator, and they're flopping around this very tiny accreting neutron star and not hitting straight on and driving these flows, and see all this structure coming out from that protoneutron star. That's all driven by the accretion flow, not by some neutron star wagging around driving acoustic flux or anything. Okay, it's all driven by the shock wave. Okay, now you see that beautiful bipolar structure, but it's computed on a two-dimensional grid with an axis of symmetry right there. So you just can't trust it. Okay, you've got to be able to do this in 3D to see if that structure really survives if I remove the assumption of axis symmetry. So let's just put this on a big box. Fortunately, DOE has lots of big computers, so doing this is pretty easy. Although, when you start running these large simulations and your data files start looking like hundreds of gigabytes and the total data is terabytes, looking at that data turns out to be a nightmare. So I just throw in this advertisement that after a couple of years of struggling, we found this software, Ensight, that allows us to look at terabyte data on a typical Linux cluster, and it's just been a godsend to us to be able to analyze this stuff. So here's the first visualization I ever did of our three-dimensional stuff with that software. And so this is a surface of, this is the shock surface out here. these transparent surfaces are colored by the gas entropy. And I've kicked this one off with an L equals 1 mode by putting a pressure wave right here. This is actually the entropy mark of that pressure wave. So the pressure wave is going to fly out while this kind of just sits there. But it's going to kick off this spherical accretion shock instability. And so the first result is, hey, it exists in 3D. You get a very nice axisymmetric growing oscillation out of this thing, even in 3D. And in fact, you can see the average shock radius is in fact increasing. So we can take a perfectly spherically symmetric accretion shock in 3D, put in random pressure perturbations in the interior, small, you know, 1% pressure perturbations, and let this L equals 1 mode grow out of it. And what we'll see is in fact a very beautiful axisymmetric structure, except that that axis of symmetry is just totally randomly oriented on our grid. We'll go back and run the exact same thing but change the random seed, and we'll get the exact same looking structure but oriented at some other angle, some random angle on our Cartesian grid. So the fact that you produce this very axisymmetric structure out of what is essentially a perfectly spherical supernova shock is a pretty robust result. Okay, so to try and visualize what exactly is going on here, this is a two-dimensional slice from a three-dimensional simulation. This is that parameter pressure times r to the 4. And so, go ahead and get this rolling. So a couple things to note. One is that inside a fairly large radius, nothing is going on. Okay, the changing pressure, at least in the linear regime, all happens sort of at this characteristic radius. So there's high pressure, and then it propagates down here, and then up to there, and back down again. Now the other thing to note is that there's a very clear transition to the nonlinear when that wave steepens and forms an internal shock. If I can catch it. Okay, so here we've got the flow coming back down, and you form a shock here. In fact, there's also a shock of a wave, more spherical wave, coming out from the interior. So maybe there is something spherical involved here. And then we end up with this shock triple point, which we'll see in other simulations or other visualizations. But that then propagates. This shock triple point is now kind of a ring around the outside of the shock, and we'll see that go from pole to pole to pole. Okay, so here's that shock triple point, and here it's converging in on the pole, and it's probably not surprising. The idea is that this shock triple point comes in, meets itself at the pole, perfectly axisymmetric, bounces back and comes back as a circle and meets on the other pole. But it's just not going to be exactly symmetric. In fact, in the interior, there's now shear being developed and all sorts of stuff going on, so we know we're not going to have a perfectly spherical situation. Plus, in a real supernova, there's a lot of other stuff going there, and there is thermal convection going on. And so it's not surprising that when this thing meets at the pole, it doesn't meet head-on, and in fact breaks that axisymmetry. And so we get something that looks pretty ugly here. And so in fact, after only a couple oscillations in the nonlinear stage, this thing breaks this axisymmetry. So while, yes, we do have this very powerful axisymmetric mode in the linear regime, it doesn't take much in the nonlinear regime before that's out the window. Okay? All right, so the next surprise was we're running these models tracking the linear momentum accreted onto the neutron star in the core, for looking for kicks. Does this thing sloshing up and down give enough linear momentum to produce a kick? Well, we decided to go ahead, as long as we're tracking accretion of linear momentum, track the accretion of angular momentum. That's where we got a little bit of a surprise. If you watch this sloshing, it kind of turns into a motion coming around. And you develop a fairly strong rotation pattern here. And look at the angular momentum accreted onto the neutron star. These, in fact, turn out to be huge numbers. By the way, in order to follow this, we had to map this onto a bigger and bigger Cartesian box. So by this point, we're running a simulation with a billion zones. So that's where we started running into this data nightmare. So here is a plot over time of the angular momentum on the neutron star. But we've also plotted the angular momentum of all the accreting gas. And those two numbers, so you can see I've got two lines here, are very nearly equal and opposite. So the net angular momentum in our box starts zero and stays zero, very to within one part in a thousand. So what happens is we get in this accretion shock flow, we've got everything moving in one direction and the neutron star spinning in the opposite direction. And in fact, so what I've plotted here is the angular frequency of a isolated neutron star if it had that amount of angular momentum. So you can see that in a time span of only 200 or 300 milliseconds, you can spin that guy up so that it's spinning with a period of order 35 milliseconds. So these are huge angular momentum accretion rates. Here's just a visualization, a volume rendering of the angular momentum. The shock is kind of coming towards you, and so it's rotating around a vertical axis. Well, we scale to what people get out of the 1D models. I can't pull that number right off the top of my head. Okay, so here is, so this is the shape of the shock. That triple point that in the axisymmetric mode went all the way around the star really now only goes about halfway around the star. So you sort of have a kidney bean picture with this part is propagating out around, spiraling around. And here I've got a 2D slice in the equatorial plane of the rotation. Here's the entropy inside. So here we have a high entropy gas swinging around like this. And what happens is the low entropy gas ahead of that gets pushed in, and here's the velocity vector field creates this very fast stream of gas coming right down towards the accreting star, and that's where this high angular momentum accretion rate comes from. Now here, I've actually flipped the color map on the entropy. I apologize for that. So this is the high entropy part leading to the spiral sassy wave coming around, and that's what's driving this accretion of angular momentum. It turns out to be a remarkably stable feature. So just about every single three-dimensional simulation that we run has eventually turned into this spiral mode. Okay, quickly time here. So to try and look at this more carefully, I had a summer REU student do some two-dimensional simulations in the equatorial plane. So we set up a two-dimensional model that we can run very quickly and do lots of analysis on. And here is one of our results. We have a numerical artifact at theta of zero, but she was able to excite this with small perturbations so we could watch it and measure the growth in the linear regime. So this, again, is a linear instability. You don't need a large magnitude, just some tiny little perturbation to kick it off and watch it grow exponentially. And we stop it when it sort of breaks into that nonlinear phase. The coloring here is theta velocity, so the blue is going one way, the red the other way. And so here, right at about the time it becomes nonlinear, is the flow pattern. Again, you can see this very strong flow heading down towards the surface, the accreting star. Now here we can very carefully monitor the angular momentum accretion rate. So here's in the linear regime, we get this very nice exponential increase, but it's alternating signs. We're spinning the star one way and then the other, and back and forth until we break into the nonlinear regime, and then we get a very high sustained angular momentum spinning that star up. Another interesting result of this, which may be a clue to the nature of this instability, is that we can take this 2D model that goes from 0 to 2 pi, and we can excite the spiral wave, or we can excite the L equals 1, just sloshing back and forth. And the growth rates and the periods look very, very similar. And I think in terms of this acoustic mode, it's a natural result, because one is just a pressure wave going from pole to pole like this, and the other is a pressure wave just going around in a circle. So it's not surprising that the period's exactly the same if the feedback is just how much that pressure is perturbing the shock and the feedback. It's not surprising that you get the same result. Okay, so in the last minute, I promised Rob I'd show him why he's wrong. So here's a supernova remnant that, I meant to take that word off. But so here is, we just take some ejecta and blow it up and try to produce something that creates something that looks like a jet, like in Cassé. Okay, so this is a three-dimensional simulation. The blue transparent surface is the forward shock wave. This is all the shocked ejecta, and so that's all the structure created by the Rayleigh-Taylor instability in the self-similar driven wave phase. It's colored by Vt over R. So if it's less than 1, it's decelerated gas. And this red stuff has a Vt over R of unity or a little higher. So you'd look at this stuff, look at its radial motion, and say it's undecelerated. Okay? But in fact, it's not. It was decelerated and has been re-accelerated. The simulation was created not from a jet explosion or even an asymmetric explosion. It was created from a purely spherically symmetric explosion. So here's radius versus theta. And so we have perfectly spherically symmetric ejecta. But what we do is put slightly lower density along the polar region and higher density along the equator. And this was a model that we published many years ago with Roger and Peter Lundquist. But we kind of resurrected it here. And so here's the reverse shock and the forward shock. Let me go ahead and run this. And we see what happens. So watch these Rayleigh-Taylor fingers grow. Okay, but because the non-radial motion imparted by the non-spherical shock, they are actually advected all the way into this jet of material. Okay, so we have a very strange effect that's all driven by non-radial dynamics. The fact that this shock wave, this reverse shock, is not spherically symmetric is driving material in. And so, in fact, this jet is composed of both material from deep inside that just recently So this shocked ejecta here is both stuff that was shocked early on, so outer layers of the ejecta that was then advected in here, but also stuff from deeper in that more recently went through the reverse shock that's mixed in with that. So you have a much more complicated composition here than you would expect just based on spherically symmetric models. So I throw this out just as a word of warning that multidimensional effects can be very strange and hard to predict. Thank you.
As the neutron star accretes it also gains linear momentum. But I notice that your neutron star is always sort of seems fixed in space.
Yes. So these particular models have that the gravity is fixed. So we now have 2D models where it's allowed to move, but these particular ones it's fixed.
Probably I just don't understand your calculations. Why aren't the Rayleigh-Taylor fingers formed in the forward shock fluids?
Pardon?
Why isn't there Rayleigh-Taylor's fingers also formed in the forward shocked fluid?
Basically, this happens because the whole thing is being decelerated as it runs into circumstellar medium. And so we have this dense shocked ejecta being decelerated by this lighter shocked CSM material. And so it's a Rayleigh-Taylor instability.
The contact discontinuity, I assume, becomes very complicated.
Right. So that would be the contact.
And you're running into a lighter fluid, no doubt.
Yes. So this particular model, you're running into an R to the minus 2 density profile.
So why in the forward shock, when the accumulated material builds up, it also doesn't have Rayleigh-Taylor fingers?
There is a slight density gradient here in the shock CSM, but it's pretty minor compared to this density contrast between this stuff and this dense stuff.
In the studies of the instability, what would be the saturation level? Is there any damping mechanism operating there?
There's this fairly clear transition to nonlinear when the internal waves steepen to form a shock, and that point sort of everything breaks loose and you're no longer on this nice power log growth. And it's fairly easy that occurs when the shock distortion is about 20% or so. So that linear phase is, the shock still is fairly spherically symmetric. But beyond that point, as you've seen, once it becomes nonlinear, it's just a mess.
Uh, John, you talked about the angular momentum transport of the neutron star, and it was always one-signed, i.e. you got spin-up perennially. Did you have any cases where you got occasional episodic spin-down during the, you know, of opposite
yes.
sun? You did get that?
Yes. So,
and when? How did you get that? I mean,
well,
how did it happen?
I mean, often we would see this very dominant spiral mode, but there's other modes going on, and what we'd sometimes see is that we'd kind of, there'd be a sloshing mode, and L equals one mode that'd take over briefly, and then when the spiral mode came back, it was in the opposite sense. So seeing that reversal did happen. Now, one thing to point out is that, you know, this whole thing is on timescales of hundreds of milliseconds, and so this supernova explosion, as we'll hear shortly, is hopefully going to happen on, you know, a timescale of only on that same timescale. So how much of this actually happens, we've yet to see in a real supernova.
I'll probably shout it out. So in the angular momentum diagram you're showing, there are two reversals. You start the sign of the reversal.
Yes.
The non-reversal.
Yes.
At the end of the day, you expect it to be the last 30 to dominate.
Yes. Right.
In this case, how it's completely sketched at that point. There's no secular thing. It's reversing.
That's right.
Okay.
Yes.
John, so I was curious. I mean, yeah, this is really nice for the simulations you showed. For in a real supernova explosion, when there's lots more going on, do you think that this would actually cause the stalled accretion shock to move out, or would it just keep sort of oscillating around itself but not?
I'm going to have to refer to our next speaker for that.
You don't know. I mean, what is your? What do you think?
These models that I'm running are not going to tell us if a supernova yeah. explodes or not. You've got to put in the other physics.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. When you're still accreting stuff, do you think this will still happen though, or?
Well, we certainly see the L equals one mode going on. Tomas has been going to 3D. I don't know if they've seen some of the spiral mode yet, but so I think this physics is relevant. Now, how much it contributes to an explosion mechanism, I don't know. The numerical method is based on the PPM algorithm. So the code is called VH1 and is publicly available. We've got an MPI version of it that you can download off the web page. So it's just standard Lagrangian map version of Kellele-Woodward's PPM.
Any other question?
The numerical box?
Yes.
In zones, we get up to about 1,000 cubed. 1,000 cubed. So that the domain size of order gets out to be of order 500 kilometers in radius, 1,000 kilometers in diameter.
How much of a density contrast did you need to make the jet?
This particular one is 4-1, but you can get by with considerably less than that. You just have to wait longer before it develops.
One more question. Do you start off with a rotating star, or just a...
No.
Okay, so would that change the whole mode thing or not?
Yeah. Well, no. We've done some 3D with rotation, so the initial model is rotating. So the angular momentum I was showing you was a spherically symmetric non-rotating star, and in the end you've got a neutron star spinning with 35 millisecond period. I don't think anybody in this room would have guessed that would be possible. Now it takes some rotation, and your accretion shock is distorted because of that rotation, and your L equals 1 is going to preferably follow that rotation axis. But when it breaks into the nonlinear stage, it falls over and starts spinning around an axis that's perpendicular to your original stellar spin. So in fact, you end up with a neutron star spinning with an axis perpendicular to your progenitor's spin.
So the rotation direction is decided randomly?
Yeah. I mean, what we see is that the rotation axis always ends up typically being roughly perpendicular to the L equals 1 mode, but that L equals 1 mode, if we perturb it with random perturbations, that axis is totally random. Now there may be other physics going on, as in with rotation or maybe fields or something else that can pick that axis, but
Okay, so yeah, I want to run on with that question. John, if you put in a magnetic field, a strong magnetic field in the neutron star, do you think that you'd be able to kick it in one direction or the other? In other words, have aligned rotation with the magnetic field dipole vector or anti-aligned preferentially? Or not lined at all, oblique rotators preferentially? Got any gut feeling on that?
No.
No, okay.
Sorry.
Last question. Okay, so let's thank the speaker again. Our next